You're listening to Market Champions, a podcast on navigating the financial markets. Here's your host, Srivastava Prakash.
Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of Market Champions. Today, I've got Mike Green. Mike Green is Portfolio Manager, Chief Strategist at Simplify. Most of you know well, most of you are probably tired of hearing him, but here's another podcast of Mike Green talking again.
Wow, most of you are tired of hearing me, but we can make it a short podcast then. Yeah. How's that? No, it does feel like I'm pretty overexposed versus the last time that that we chatted, which is how you and I met for the first time.
Yep, 100%. And Mike, you know, so to sort of kick it off, one thing that's been in everyone's minds and sort of controlled the narrative over the last couple of months has been the state of the labor market and this narrative around a soft landing. And so, you know, when you sat firmly in the transitory camp. That inflation would pass, and you know, inflation seems to be passing. But the Fed believes that they can propagate the soft landing similar to what happened in 1994. So, one, you know, are the probabilities of this of a soft landing, you know, considerably higher, and maybe the highest probability if you look at the distribution? Is that the most likely outcome? You know, how are you thinking about it? And what was your take on the jobs report that came out last Friday?
Well, so I've been pretty clear on this. I think, one of the real challenges that we're facing is that this is a meaningfully different recession than those that came before it. They're all unique in their own way, but this one is very much characterized by a labor market that is bifurcated. There's an incredible shortage in the labor market tied to jobs that involve physical labor, proximity to old people, retail physical locations, fast casual restaurants, etc. In all of those areas, we're seeing a shortage of workers that has largely been predicted for a long time, right? We've seen declining rates of population or declining levels of population for those with less than a college graduate degree. In particular, those with a less than high school degree who would often have competed for many of the construction jobs or for many of the things like an orderly in a nursing home. You know, that population is empirically shrinking and being replaced by those who have gone off to college and obtained various forms of student loan debt, et cetera, that forces them to seek higher levels of employment. And I just want to highlight that for people. If you look at something like the overall unemployment rate, you'll see that that's now fallen to about 3.43%. That is similar to what it was going into the pandemic. I believe that this puts it at its absolute low, but it was 3.47 on a three-digit basis going into COVID. So we've really been here before. We've experienced these types of dynamics. We were looking at wages that were going up and pressure that existed on corporate profit margins for this reason previously. What we didn't have in that environment was a narrative that said inflation and Ben Hunt narrative form is here, right? And so corporations were slow to raise prices because they were uncertain as to what market power they had. Now we're actually looking at a condition under which the unemployment rate is in total around 3.43%, right? So very, very low. But if I look at the unemployment rate for those with a bachelor's degree or higher, while in absolute terms that number is lower, it's actually quite a bit higher than it has been historically. And so this is a useful point to raise, particularly in the context of what we're actually seeing at this exact moment. So if you go back into the mid-1990s, the unemployment rate heading into 2000 for those with a college degree was 1.47%. The lowest it got in this cycle was 1.78%, so give or take 30% higher. And we've actually now seen that number move back above 2%, which is, you know, higher than it was going into the 2007 recession, 2007, 2008 recession. We've seen that now rise for about 3 months in a row. And I think this actually highlights why we're experiencing such a divergence between the narrative of recession and the signals of recession, whether it be inverted yield curve, slowing home prices, or turning negative, slowing home construction, things that historically have been very clear signals of recession are now not showing up in the labor market. And part of the reason why I would suggest that this is happening is because of the character of who's losing their jobs this time around. So it's not the, you know, cyclical gardener who is being faced with unemployment, because candidly, we can't find enough of them. It's not the cyclical plumber who is facing unemployment, or the assembly line worker that's facing significant unemployment. Where we're seeing the unemployment is in the quote unquote professional ranks, right? Those whose jobs require them to have a college degree. Just to put in context what people are hanging their hat on, they're looking at things like initial jobless claims and saying there's no real sign that this is going up in a traditional sign of recession. But what that's missing is the character of what you're actually hitting there, right? People don't lose their jobs and automatically file for unemployment. They're making a choice. And the layoffs that we're seeing at places like Google, for example, where the median employee that is being laid off has a compensation package somewhere around $275,000, right? This is a well-compensated employee. If they're considering filing for unemployment, which one, may be prohibited by terms of their severance package, but two, what would you guess the maximum unemployment benefit that you can receive in the state of California is?
I'm guessing probably maybe $500 a month-ish.
So it's a little higher than that. You're the very first person who's ever guessed the low. Most people tell me a number that they think the maximum benefit is somewhere in the neighborhood of $100,000 to $150,000 a year, right? That actually gives you some idea how rarely people in that situation encounter unemployment. The maximum benefit in the state of California is $450 a week for 26 weeks, so a total of roughly $13,000, right? Slightly less than $13,000.
Yeah.
If you just got fired from your $275,000 a year job, are you going to rush off to navigate the intricacies of the California Unemployment Office? Or are you going to take your, you know, as you might phrase it, your long deserved vacation to Hawaii? My sense the latter, is that most people will do the latter, right? As a result, they don't show up as filing for unemployment. If you're watching carefully though, full-time employment peaked back in May, right? May of 2022. As I mentioned, the proportion of the population with a bachelor's degree or higher that is experiencing unemployment has been rising since September. So we're seeing the signs. We're just not interested in paying attention to them, right? They feel very at odds with the top line data that we're getting.
Got it. Yeah. And you know, I think, you know, the most important point that you highlighted was, you know, for a normal, quote unquote, normal recession, usually the jobs that are lost, or as you mentioned, it's the, you know, it's the cyclical gardener, as opposed to, you know, the highly paid finance or, you know, highly paid tech professional. But here, you know, the layoffs are sort of concentrated around professionals who require a college degree rather than the cyclical gardener. And so, you know, what are the implications of that? So, both from a recess. So, you know, obviously, you know, someone who makes $270,000 a year has a stronger balance sheet, or likely, you know, strong savings base. And therefore, and that's probably also one of the factors that contributes to them not filing for unemployment, because they're already they tend to be decently financially well off. And so, you know, what are sort of the implications of that? Does that mean, you know, if a recession were to set in, you know, the impact of a recession would be lighter, because, you know, the poorer, quote unquote, poorer workers have jobs, while the richer ones, the wealthier ones, are the ones who are being laid off?
So it's an interesting question. And again, we actually don't know the answer, right? Do they continue to spend on a life cycle hypothesis framework, effectively trying to smooth their consumption over time? Again, we genuinely don't know the answer to that, right? And we can hypothesize on how this is likely to play out. But I would suggest that you may be right in that it's delayed, right? That if I worked at Google and I made $275,000 a year, I probably think of myself as being worth $275,000 a year, right? And the experience of Silicon Valley or many parts of the United States for years has been one that says something along the lines of, gosh darn it, I'm smart enough, good enough, and people like me, therefore, you know, I'm worth that sort of compensation. I have a hunch that what we're seeing in the tech sector is going to look an awful lot like what we saw in financial services following the Dodd-Frank reform in 2008, which is many people that lose their job in this recession may never work in a job that attractive ever again. And that's a pretty severe statement to make, but it's certainly borne out by the history. And if you look at the one characteristic that really kicks in, as your job becomes more and more specialized, as you move higher up the ladder in terms of the skill set that you're involved with, let's say you're a marketing executive with Google, the simple reality is that you're going to avoid taking the job that pays $150,000 a year because it doesn't really solve your problem. And in fact, it creates its own new set of problems, right? When I worked at Google, I got paid $275. Therefore, what was I worth? $275. If I take a job with, you know, Joe's Computer Shack being paid $150,000 a year, well, now I'm only worth $150,000 a year, right? If I get laid off from Joe's Computer Shack, or I decide to change my job from Joe's Computer Shack and they ask me, how much money are you making? And I say, well, when I was at Google, they'd paid me $275,000 a year, right? That sounds awfully disingenuous. They don't care what I made at Google. They care what I'm making now, right? And so there's a permanent downshift that occurs that is very similar to the type of downshift that we saw for Detroit auto workers, Caterpillar employees in Peoria, Illinois in the 1970s, 1980s, farmers in the 1980s, et cetera. Like, this is a meaningful downgrade that is likely underway that I would suggest that most people haven't fully considered yet. And if you look at the one statistic that really kind of sticks out, the duration of unemployment has risen dramatically in every recession that we've had for the past 40 years as more and more workers become quote unquote specialized knowledge workers whose skills are not transferable in the same way that an assembly line worker at Ford could almost immediately hop over to be an assembly line worker at General Motors.
Got it. And so what you're trying to say is, now, potentially, if this sort of plays out in the way Dodd-Frank played out for the financial services industry, so a lot of people who are making, you know, $275,000 and then got laid off, you know, they might see a permanent shift lower in their income, you know, going into sort of, say, the next 10, 15 years.
Unfortunately, I think that's right.
Got it.
That loss in the permanent income framework is going to be significant.
Got it. Yeah. And so with regards to that, you know, one thing that has been pointed out is with the low rates that were provided in the aftermath of March 2020 and, you know, over the course of the pandemic, you know, a lot of companies got to refinance and fix their balance sheets up. And in addition, you know, you got private sector balance sheets are the strongest they've ever been. And, you know, people use that as a case to argue that the economy is in a pretty strong state, and there's a good chance that, you know, it could weather a hard recession or a recession in general. And you know, what's your take on that? Do you think private sector balance sheets matter as much as, you know, the consensus sort of thinks it does?
Wait, could you repeat that? Do I think what?
Do you think private sector balance sheets, or the strength of private sector balance sheet, do you think, you know, that is overstated? Do you think it matters as much as the consensus does?
No, I think it absolutely matters. I think it just becomes a question. I mean, we have a credit system that is largely collateral driven, not income driven, right? So, you know, the my income doesn't matter nearly as much in approving a loan as does my ability to put 20% or 40% down on a house. If I can put 40% down on a house, it really doesn't matter what my income is. The bank will lend me money, right? Because they're secure in their collateral.
Yeah.
So if I see my stocks improve in price, if I see the bonds that I hold rise in value, if I see my portfolio increase or my home increase in value, then I have much less concern about my ability to access credit and cash flow. And in fact, California is almost a walking testament to this dynamic, right? The number of people who have been able to survive, even though their incomes were relatively low versus many of those in technology, they were early on the property ladder, right? And they've been able to tap into various forms of financing where they've kept costs contained in the form of Prop 13, which is going to be a rising issue for many of those who move to Texas or other places, where they don't have the same sort of indexing. And you could very well see a surprise on the property tax front. If you happen to live in Nashville or somewhere else, right? It's those things start to change pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm. And so I guess sort of the broad question is, do you still believe in this idea of a hard landing, or do you think it's a lot more uncertain going forward?
Well, I think there's a ton of uncertainty, but I would suggest that, again, it becomes very hard to avoid a hard landing, right? I mean, we have tapped into credit cards. We've tapped in. And by the way, I just want to be clear. A lot of people think that when you start talking about tapping into credit cards, you're talking about the bottom of the income distribution. That's actually not who has access to credit cards, right? The bottom quintile of the distribution really doesn't have access to credit cards. It's that, you know, next two quintiles, the kind of 20 to 60th percentile, that really have access to credit cards, where I would suggest we're starting to see the stress. It's those who have a college degree, are working in the labor force, working in jobs that are possibly automated, and that really have not seen the sort of wage gains that we've seen elsewhere in the economy. People forget that there's two components to wage gains. One is just the absolute tightness of the labor market. Mm-hmm. Second is, you know, the changing character of the labor force, right? So at 30, I expect to have relatively rapid wage gains as I gain experience in my job. If I come straight out of an undergraduate degree, I should expect to see wages gaining very, very rapidly and then slowly plateauing as my ability to gain experience rapidly diminishes, right? We don't have an entering younger generation in the same way that the millennials are now transitioning out of that. The modal millennial, I believe, is about 32 years old. Because they were born in 1990, right? So they're now about 32 years old. They're hitting the point of diminishing returns in terms of wage gains, et cetera. So, you know, it's very hard to demographically adjust all this stuff. But I guess I'm not really all that surprised that we've seen some of the wage pressures that we've seen in the face of a labor force that has a, you know, highly educated young cohort that is now really pushing through in a big way. Whether that's inflationary or whether that creates the potential for a wage price spiral, to me feels very different. And that's, you know, something that we've talked about. Like, we have by and large seen, certainly on a shorter term basis, if I look at month over month inflation, mm-hmm. we've seen a very rapid retreat, almost exactly as I had forecast on a transitory basis. The aggregates being maintained so far, at least, is largely a function of things like owner's equivalent rent, et cetera, which moves very slowly. And candidly, I'm in a little bit of shock that the Fed is still behaving in the way that it is. Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, one of the headlines that came across in the past few days is college grads experienced the largest real decline in wages in their history. That does not sound like a super tight labor market.
Yep. And so, you know, sort of on that note, you know, what the Fed has been able to do is, you know, the Fed has sort of had, I guess, you know, you could say two goals. So one has been convincing the market that the terminal rate was somewhere between 5.25%. And the second thing was, and we've seen this over the last couple of Fed speeches, I think Powell did one last week, and he did one before that, and during the last interest rate hike. And you know, the thing that he's talked about is going forward. You know, there is sort of the market was pricing in about three cuts before the end of the year, and you know, the Fed and you know, Powell was sort of very strict on how you know, the market might be pricing in, or you know, the Fed may not necessarily be cutting. Cutting as soon as the market expected. And so, you know, so the Fed seemed to be able to convince the market on the first point where the terminal rate was somewhere around 5%. But, you know, on the second point of you know, remaining hawkish throughout the rest of the year, you know, it's not been, the Fed has not been as convincing. And so, you know, when it comes to markets, you know, what are you seeing? You know, what are you observing? You know, what do you find? You know, what are you finding interesting? Because, you know, at the start of the year, you know, a lot of it has been sort of short covering action. You know, a lot of the stuff that did really poorly last year, you know, say short, you know, the ARK stocks, the unprofitable tech, you know, high beta tech, etc. You know, they've just come roaring back. Like if you look at Caravana and so on. So
Carvana, not Caravan, but yeah.
Carvana,
you know, again, that to me kind of fits broadly into the picture of people attempting to rebalance and reallocate portfolios that they had largely engaged in tax loss harvesting activity, right? Mm-hmm. You know, so if I was in Carvana and it was an absolute disaster last year, my temptation would be to take profits and then buy it back at some point in the future if I remain convinced of it, right? That can create a significant tax benefit for me in that process. It seems like that's largely what we've experienced. And we saw this in the 2000 to 2003 cycle as well. And you've seen me draw comparisons to ARK and the unprofitable tech and the NASDAQ 100, et cetera. It's behaved remarkably similarly, where at every step in the process, people haven't really been disabused of the notion that, like, you know, Cathie Wood is a genius stock picker. What they're really focused on at this point is just trying to keep their nose as clean as they possibly can and avoid making judgments. So they go to reallocate back in. And the wonderful thing about stocks like that is, you know, if you thought that GameStop was a buy at, you know, $150 a share, it must be fantastically cheap at these levels, right? Why would you stop investing in it? Unless you actually, you know, say, hey, wait a second, you know, this is a company that, you know, really has no real reason to exist anymore, right? I, you know, have you ever been in a Bed Bath and Beyond? I know you live in Canada, but have you ever been in one?
No, we have a, we sort of have an equivalent here called Bath and Body Works.
Yep.
But I have not, no.
You've never been in Bath and Body Works?
I've been in a Bath and Body Works, but I've never been in a Bed Bath and Beyond.
Okay. So Bath and Body Works is more, I at least would think of it as more a competitor to like the Body Shop. It's selling more products in terms of shampoos and stuff like that, and scrubbers, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
As compared to Bed Bath and Beyond,
okay,
towels and kitchen appliances and
mattresses,
you know, various forms of Schottky that, you know, you may or may not ever use again once you've purchased it as a gift.
Okay. My bad.
But on those products, like, there's no shortage of places that I can buy them, right? I mean, if I want to buy towels, I can get them at Bed Bath & Beyond. I can get them at Target. I can get them at Walmart. I can pay up and get them at Pottery Barn. I can, you know, like, there's no shortage of competitive places for me to get it. I genuinely struggle with, like, what is the compelling value proposition of a Bed Bath and Beyond, right? Or for that matter, really even physical retail other than some of the destination retail types, or at the low end, you know, the Walmarts, et cetera, of the world that very clearly are doing a great job of competing for that next marginal customer in a way that Bed Bath and Beyond is not.
Mm-hmm. And so sort of your the problem with Bed Bath and Beyond is what they sell is one, a durable good, but at the same time it's pretty commoditized, and in the sense that, you know, what you get at Bed Bath and Beyond, you know, you could go to say Walmart and buy, you know, a similar towel and buy, say, groceries and other stuff together.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, you could again, having you not having been in a Bed Bath and Beyond makes it a little bit more challenging to explain, but you know, think more like a Canada Kmart or a you know, it's genuinely more of a category killer department store that is the place to go if you want to look at all the different varieties of comforter cover or shower curtain that you might be able to get. And the inventory is bigger and cheaper at Walmart and Amazon, certainly in the online space. Right. I mean, I just can't think of a compelling reason why I would ever want to go to Bed Bath & Beyond other than to return something that somebody bought at Bed Bath & Beyond.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you know, I think what going back to markets, you know, one of the other dynamics that we've observed is, total options volume traded in the market, I think, has hit an all-time high. And, considering, your work and your experience in options markets, what's sort of your take on that? You know, where is that coming from? And, what are the implications of it?
Well, so I just want to be very clear. There's a distinction between the value of the options market has hit an all-time high and the level of trading has hit an all-time high.
I believe it was total options volume.
Volume and contracts outstanding that has grown relative to total premium that has been spent.
Yeah.
Right. And the big reason there is the introduction of 0-day to expiry options, which allow an unbelievable amount of volume to transact. They make up more than 50% of all daily volume now in terms of U.S. option exchanges. Almost all of that is occurring simply on the S&P 500, the SPYs. They're just about to introduce 0-day to expiry options on the Russell, et cetera. And in those conditions, instead of buying a 3-month option and recognizing, or selling a 3-month option and recognizing that transactions are my enemy, in the case of 0-day to expiry options, they go off my books before they even clear. So, what a wonderful vehicle, right? The minute I make a little bit of profit, I step away because I know I can't reasonably have any form of edge on that short of a time horizon.
In a way, would you say the functionality or like the way, they work is similar to a binary option, just because on a 0-day to, on a 0-DTE, on a 0-DTE expiry, it sort of, it goes either one way or the other. And so if it's in the money, the value of your option skyrockets, but otherwise, there's also a chance that if it's just, considering how short the time frame is, would you argue that it's similar to the way a binary option behaves?
There's obvious parallels, right? But remember, the binary option doesn't necessarily have to exhibit the same gamma dynamics unless it has knock-in or knock-out characteristics, right? So I would maybe describe it more as like a knock-in binary, right? If you fall beyond a certain level, then it goes to one. If you fall below a certain level, it goes to zero, right? And we can create both of those conditions. If I were to model that option and it had multiple days to expiry, preferably something in the neighborhood of a month or 2 months, which would be kind of a very typical trade in that sort of space, it doesn't behave like a 0-day to expiry option at all, right? Because I can transit the moneyness on a continuous basis, and yet I've still got a fairly significant curve shape that is influencing that price behavior, right? Whereas in the world that you're inhabiting, the only possible source of realizing those dynamics is, by sitting steady with the option as it currently exists, right? I can't trade options on a daily basis that have 3 months to expiry because the bid ask is just too large. It's one of the awesome things about 0-day to expiry. I enter into it and it matures either in the money or out of the money, which is where your analogy to the buy area comes in.
Mm-hmm. And has the rise in activity primarily been driven by the fact that there's a lot more uncertainty about what goes on now? So it's harder to make predictions on, say, a 3-month basis or a 6-month basis or a 1-year basis. compared to historically.
So I actually don't agree with that. I do think that there's elements of key uncertainty that are developing, but I would argue that almost more than any time in history, we have certainty about what we're going to do the next day, right? Or what we're going to do a week from now.
What do you mean?
Well, our lives are relatively routine, right? Otherwise we wouldn't build things like highways and 4,000.
Sure, but I mean, from a market standpoint, so do you think the rise in zero DTE has been driven by the fact that there is additional uncertainty over a 3-month or a 6-month or a 1 year time frame? So, you know, people have resorted to trading low data or like short, very short dated options.
But I don't know that that's what they're actually doing, right? So all the evidence that I'm seeing, and I'd be interested if you see something different, is that people are selling these zero data expiry options, which allows them to effectively use them as very short dated liabilities with low probability of knocking in, right? So I continuously recreate or recognize the profits associated with that position even before it clears, right? I mean, that's theoretically free capital that I can use to express a point of view and capture a return if I think I have any advantage whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. But when you sell an option, what you're trying to do, like if I sold a 3-month option, you know, there's some sort of theta value that's in that option versus a zero DTE option where, you know, ideally there should be very little to no time value for that option. Is my understanding wrong?
So this is part of the conversation that you and I were having beforehand, right? About how your role is somewhat different than you had thought it would be, right? Remember, what's happening in markets is not that there is a well thought out plan and here's how we're going to adapt to X, Y, and Z. It's all changed by the behavior of the participants, right? So if I look at this, what I consider to be craziness, and I say, you know what, I'm going to go out and buy a 10-year bond yielding 2.5%, right? Then in many ways, my decision process is over. There's no complexity to it whatsoever, right? I mean, I chose to buy a bond. What is it going to be worth? At maturity, it's going to be worth par, and I'm going to collect the coupon payments associated with it. If I go into equities, I have no idea what I'm going to get.
Mm-hmm. And so it's primarily driven by the fact that equities tend to be more uncertain just as an asset class.
Well, it's not just that they're more uncertain. I mean, there's this broader sense that like you can trade off equities and bonds. The history of doing that is basically slim and none, right? The only situation in which it exists is if a federal agent ultimately steps in and says, we're going to make available any amount of capital that Mike Green wants to get in San Francisco,
mm-hmm.
right? That has a huge impact. If I have to go through the traditional process of getting a job at the Federal Reserve or have to besiege the Federal Reserve to buy my property or to buy my mortgage or to buy some or to offer cheaper financing, et cetera, we're right back to the same problem that we were talking about before, right? Where largely the systems that exist on the government side are inadequate to deal with the shocks that we're facing.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Let me flip it around to you for a second, though. Like, you know, so you started this off by saying, is there going to be a mea culpa? Is there an element of saying the data is much, much stronger than you thought it was going to be? And I want to be very clear, like, I have been surprised by the developments as well. It's only since I dove down into the details that I feel somewhat comfortable that I understand it. But what are you seeing out there, Sri? What do you think is going on?
I believe the chances of a soft landing in the sense that the unemployment rate stays relatively constant while inflation comes down. I think the probabilities are higher than I initially thought. Like initially when the Fed started hiking, I think way back, I think it's been over a year since the Fed has started hiking. But
Almost exactly a year.
My view is my view is so there so my view is potentially if we see job losses, they might be more delayed than initially expected. I think the initial belief around job losses was it was supposed to be around Q2, but I think there is a chance that we see that happen around say Q4 or towards the end of the year rather than sooner. And that's primarily driven by I think the fact that private sector balance sheets being as strong as they are and how companies have used this sort of refinancing used the zero rates during COVID as sort of an opportunity to refinance or essentially bring down their cost of debt. I think that's the thing that's that is interesting. But the other thing is I would also expect the Fed to hold. And what they want to do is higher for longer. And so while they would stop hiking, it would be similar to what we saw at the Bank of Canada, where where the central bank would stop hiking, but they would just continue to hold rates at that new higher level until inflation comes down. But I think the probabilities, and I don't think it's anywhere near a certainty, but I think the probabilities of the soft landing are higher than what I initially considered.
Why?
Well, one, you know, we haven't, and I just mean that purely from an unemployment standpoint. So typically, so a hard landing would be, from what I know of you, a hard landing would be inflation comes down to, you know, back to its 3-ish or 2%. But at the same time, unemployment shoots higher. But I think, you know, the Fed is going to be able to do that while maintaining unemployment at a relatively low level. I think one of the points that you made at the start was key. So the layoffs that we're seeing right now, you know, from say Amazon, Google, the tech companies, or the investment banks, you know, these are the companies that have done incredibly well over the 2020 to 2021 period. You know, when we had to stay at home, you know, the quarantines and the lockdowns in 2020, you know, the companies that did incredibly well were the tech companies, you know, the Metas, the Googles, the Amazons, the Amazons of the world. And, you know, when we went into 2021, if I remember correctly off the top of my head, you know, JP Morgan, Goldman Sachs, they had record years within their investment banking divisions. And now we saw, I think Goldman Sachs cut about 7-ish% of their workforce, 6.5%, if memory serves me correctly. Mm-hmm. And so the layoffs that we're seeing is one, as you mentioned, in the higher paid jobs, but two, it's also in the, it's from the companies that benefited significantly during the COVID-19 and the aftermath of the COVID-19 pandemic. But in addition to that, what does concern me is one, how weak the housing market has been, and two, the level of inversion on the yield curve. And as much as the fact that it's inverted itself is usually a strong recession signal, from what I understand, if we have an inverted yield curve, and you know, banks tend to make decisions to lend based on the slope of the yield curve, because they borrow short and lend long. You know, they quote unquote borrow from, let's say, savings accounts, or say from the Fed on a 1 month or a 3 month basis. And then they lend out, say, 30-year mortgages, or they, you know, finance a 10-year long purchase of an industrial property or something of that sort. And in Canada, it's a little bit different, but in the US, I understand that most mortgages tend to be 30-year fixed rate. In Canada, it's 5-year floating, and they readjust every 5 years. And so that's one of the reasons why I believe that the Fed will have to cut, because otherwise one of the key drivers of lending, which is the yield curve and the yield and the sort of net interest margin, that has been massively eroded, looking at the level of inversion on the yield curve. And so that's one. And then two, from a Canadian standpoint, from what I've read, and from what I understand, so a lot of the housing prices around which the Canadian economy has been built, and which have gone absolutely nuts over the last decade, are finally coming down. So I think the prices of housing in the suburbs of Toronto and in the city of Toronto itself are down roughly 20 to 25%, depending on where you look, from their highs. And And the second thing is, as I mentioned, a lot of these people who bought houses in say 2017 or 2018, when rent prices were still pretty high, they are going to see their mortgages, they're going to see their mortgage payments reset at these new high rates. And so, if this is the new normal, and if rates at 4.5% are the new normal, 4.5% from the Bank of Canada, if that is the new normal for interest rates, then I think it becomes very, very difficult to make your mortgage payments. And I think, in that sense, Canada is definitely in a riskier spot compared to the US.
So, all right. I think there's interesting aspects to that, though, right? And I think this is one of the things that's going to be very interesting to see how the Fed responds to it. So if I think about the stimulus that was created in 2020, or the stimulus that was created post global financial crisis that allowed the balance sheets to repair themselves, it was largely a function of cutting interest rates, right? So wages grew slightly. And as I pointed out in my Substack earlier, I think on Sunday, we actually saw inflationary pressures and wage pressures rising well in advance of the COVID dynamic. Right. So it was clear that the economy was already running hot under some of these frameworks, fueled by the Trump tax cuts and everything else. Right. Now it becomes really an interesting question of, is there anything that the Fed could actually do to stimulate the economy? Right. I mean, if the Fed were to lower interest rates, for example, how many people would be able to withdraw cash or improve their cash flow characteristics from refinancing their home?
Well, I mean, that there hasn't been much home buying over the last 12 months, and not many.
Right. So that's exactly the issue, right? If I go back and I look at even the post GFC environment, right? So while interest rates had gone up, the 30-year mortgage rate had been largely flat for kind of 5 years. Right, that created conditions under which the vast majority of people had purchased their home, with an interest rate somewhere in the neighborhood of 6 to 7%. As those yields fell by 50%, the cash that was put to people's balance sheets in terms of the form of repair associated with cash flows, even if they were hammered on the value of their home, they were paying less for it. They were able to pay less for it as long as they kept their job. Right. And the vast majority of people always keep their job. Let's just be very clear about that. To get any form of stimulus out of the U.S. today would require us to take rates back to zero. Right. There's something like $5.5 trillion worth of mortgages that are struck between 2.75 and 3.25. There's basically none that are above 6%.
Yep. And so, right? So
it's going to be quite a bit harder for the Fed to get stimulus out than I think that they believe. And candidly, I just think that there's a lot of people that are, they're exhausted from the recession trade because they saw 22 as being all about a recession. Right? The market got it wrong. It forecast a recession that failed to materialize.
Or that failed to materialize as quick as it expected.
Well, whether that's true or not, I mean, it's also entirely plausible that we actually did have a recession at the beginning part of 2022, and we had the two consecutive quarters of negative growth. It's also entirely plausible that we haven't begun to see the impact of the rate increases because of the pace that they occurred at. Right. Yep. So we've not seen employment layoff in construction, for example, even as residential construction levels have plummeted. Mm-hmm. Why is the interesting question?
I mean, typically interest rates tend to take about 12 to 18 months to play out. Similarly with housing, when housing starts to go down, that tends to have roughly a 12 to 24 month lead on the rest of the economy. So it may well be a matter of time where as you mentioned, we're almost 1 year into the hiking cycle. So we're roughly, we've got a little bit more time. Maybe a thing that happened in Q2 or Q3 of this year. Where I think there's a risk. And I was speaking to someone yesterday, at one of the large hedge funds, and so what he told me was, there what happens if you know, the people who are right now calling for, say, 3500 S&P, you know, shift their forecast, you know, believe that, you know, there's no recession, shift their forecast to, say, 4200 or 4300 or 4500 S&P, and then we see an earnings recession. That's that, you know, that may, you know, that sort of, you know, scenario is interesting to consider, where the market, you know, flips it on its head, where you know, thinks that soft landing is, you know, confirmed, you know, or potentially a no landing scenario, where, you know, where inflation comes down, you know, unemployment is done, and unemployment stays in the threes, and you know, the economy, and, you know, everything chugs along as is. But then that ends up being that ends up being the incorrect view, and then, you know, we start to see these things materialize just a little bit later than what was initially forecast. So it's interesting.
Well, there's also the issue of define an earnings recession, right? Because we've kind of massaged away the whole idea of using GAAP data, right? And yet on a GAAP basis, again, profits actually peaked back in June 2022 and have been falling since. We've fallen from a level of 203 on a GAAP basis in June 22 to today we're at 181, right? So the fact that, you know, all the earnings without the bad stuff continue to remain high shouldn't really be a surprise. Again, we saw this as recently as 2020. We also saw it very, very clearly in the global financial crisis, in which those two diverged dramatically.
They did. Yep. And you know, with regards to the podcast, one more thing that I did want to discuss, and, you know, it's somewhat relevant to this, is China. And, you know, a few months ago, you know, you were sort of considering the possibility that, you know, what if China never reopens, and what we actually observed over a couple of data points was, for example, when Shanghai started to reopen, started talking about a reopen, what we saw in the consumer confidence data was there was almost no rebound. It was almost like it was almost a question of, you know, what if China reopened, but it never mattered, or, like, you know, consumers never cared. And, you know, considering how large the wealth gap in China is, you know, the rich sort of have, you know, they're sort of rich and poor. There's almost no middle class, and, you know, you know, typically the middle class and the lower class tend to be the ones who spend. You know, when you think about that, and when you think about the Chinese reopening, you know, what are you thinking? You know, a lot of people have argued that this is going to be somewhat bullish for oil from here, as well as from copper. You have people like Pia and Jurand talking about how, you know, oil could potentially hit 140 just from the Chinese reopening. So, are you, you know, what sort of your take on that? You know, how are you thinking about the Chinese reopening?
Well, I mean, I'm kind of the guy who's gone out and said, what if China never reopens, right? To the point that I've turned it into an effective meme. And it's exactly the way that you describe, right? I'm not literally saying China will never reopen. I'm saying that when China reopens, it's going to be a shadow of its former self. And I think, unfortunately, that's broadly confirmed by the data that we're seeing, right? I mean, if we look at the expectation for Chinese travelers to take international trips, you know, the China Outbound Tourism Research Institute on February 9th announced that they're expecting something like 110 million international trips in 2023. That sounds like a lot until you realize that's about two-thirds of the level pre-COVID, right? So not only has theoretically the Chinese economy grown over this time period, but there's been pent-up demand to go see relatives and friends on an international basis. And now you're telling me that it's only going to be two-thirds in that framework? That seems odd. Right? It doesn't seem in keeping with the data that I'm seeing on the record high levels of, you know, savings that supposedly the average Chinese has. Right? I just don't think it's true. I think the simple explanation is that, yes, there will be people leaving from China. Mm-hmm. They will largely be members of the CCP, right? They will largely be traveling for business purposes to demonstrate to the world China's commitment to reopening in the same way that we saw demonstrated China's commitment to zero COVID policies, right? This is, earlier today, I made a joke, or maybe it was yesterday, where somebody had highlighted, you know, the rising sentiments in Japan that old people should just all go kill themselves, right? Because they've been trapped in a gerontocracy that's been managed for the benefit of older people. And I linked to the description, you know, to a clip from the movie Braveheart, where, you know, Edward Longshanks is effete son, you know, is complaining about how terrible his father is and ultimately just gets a big backhand, right? The reality is that you can't have a society in which the young revolt against the old and have it maintain its viability. That's what the Red Guards do. That's what the brown shirts under Hitler do, right? That's the White Guards in you know, the Bolshevik Revolution, etc. You know, this type of behavior is incredibly caustic to society. There's a reason that we're taught to respect your elders, because ultimately they are operating under an institutional framework that has preserved society. And the simple reality is that, with the exception of the boomers, who are inherently evil and a terrible group of individuals, the reality is that old people tend to underreact to stuff for a reason. They've heard all sorts of crazy claims before about the future of finance or how the world is going to be changed, you know, seven different ways before sundown, right? They're very, very rarely true. We just don't inhabit that world. We inhabit a world that is largely stable today. And that's a function of the level of surplus that we've broadly achieved.
Mm-hmm.
If you start throwing that stuff apart and you start breaking those systems down, what you end up is a system, you end up with a system that is even more fragile for the individual, right? The guarantee that the government is going to be there to bail you out has been dramatically reduced. And contrary to all the, you know, masturbatory fantasies of all the libertarians out there, right, the simple reality is that they are not doing this by themselves, and they do not have the capability to do this by themselves.
And so what you're saying is, you know, the system as a whole is relatively stable, but then but on an individual basis, it's quite fragile.
On an individual basis, I would argue it is much less certain, right? But again, I think it depends on your individual choices in terms of how fragile it is,
mm-hmm.
right? But, you know, there's a reason why Keynes made the statement, and, you know, you've known me well enough to know that I'm not a you know, statist or a Keynesian or anything else, really. What I try to be is fairly pragmatic in terms of thinking about growth economics and growth accounting frameworks. And even there, we're getting some eye-opening information. Thomas Philippon's paper that I highlighted in my Substack this weekend, or the work of Ole Peters, would suggest that by and large, as a society, we've devalued the systems of social insurance and created fragility, particularly for those who are not particularly well prepared to handle it, right? I mean, love him or hate him, and most people at this point hate him, except for, you know, a few people who seem to believe him, Sam Bankman-Fried was able to go from being worth $32 billion to being penniless overnight. You know, that's a system of fragility. That's not a robust system, right? Elon Musk is creating robustness and durability through his sale of securities. Twitter ultimately is a limited liability exposure for him. Most he can lose is what he's already put into it, and maybe some of his reputation. The fact that it's created the cover for him to go out and sell Tesla shares, my God, what a win that's been. He now actually has some cash.
Being a smart businessman.
Well, I mean, he is taking advantage of the opportunities that are being given to him.
Yep. Yep. And coming back to China, one of your favorite things to talk about is geopolitics. And one thing that we've observed over the last, weekish has been, you know, this balloons, being flown from China over the US, over Canada, in sort of an espionage mission. Do you think that's fair? Assuming that, you know, these balloons were from China, and, you know, they came to inspect, or they came to observe and gather intelligence onto the U.S. defense or Canadian defense or whatever, you know, do you think these these actually matter? Do you think this is significant? And two, if you do, you know, what are sort of the implications of that going forward?
Well, so just to be clear, I believe we've shot down four balloons. Only one is confirmed to belong to China. We've shot down four objects, only one of which has been confirmed to be a balloon from China. You know, we've heard everything from aliens on down right now. I tend to fall into the camp that says, the simplest explanation is always the most accurate. If we shoot down one Chinese balloon, we're probably experiencing other Chinese balloons as compared to aliens. Likewise, in all seriousness, if a society has figured out how to navigate the emptiness of space and make it all the way into our atmosphere from across points of the galaxy unknown, kind of guessing that an F-22 is not going to be able to shoot them down, right? So I'm not particularly worried about the idea that this is aliens or anything else. I really do kind of lean into the category that says, in all likelihood, this is just weather balloons, and we've now retooled our radar systems to focus looking for something else, right? I'm sure you've experienced that dynamic of, you know, going to a strange place and seeing a sign and having it register, and then all of a sudden it's you've never seen before, and then all of a sudden you see the same sign over and over and over again, right? You're primed to identify that sort of behavior.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, on the note of balloons, you know, I saw a funny cartoon, you know, it showed the balloon flying over the House of Commons and or flying over the Parliament of Canada. And, you know, one guy goes, you know, the balloon is here to gather intelligence. And then the other guy goes, well, they've come to the wrong place.
Well, the one that is definitely funny, and two, intelligence is a catch-all term that I think accurately describes what they're doing. I mean, if I'm China and I see this sort of behavior, I basically, you know, get a bunch of people in Inner Mongolia to spend the next, you know, 6 months blowing up balloons and sending them over U.S. airspace, if for no other reason than a balloon is cheap and a missile and an F-22 scrambling is expensive. Right, it's a great way to degrade our resources by getting us to continue to do this in the same way that they get Taiwan to degrade their resources by responding to Chinese incursions of their airspace.
Mm-hmm. And you know, I wanted to finish on that note. So, you know, what sort of your, and I think this has probably evolved over time. So, you know, the last time I spoke to you about China, Taiwan, you know, your sort of view was, and you know, I think this probably remained constant, is that the U.S. is trying to reduce the strategic importance of Taiwan to itself, and therefore, you know, in the case of invasion, does not want to be heralded with the responsibility to defend or protect Taiwan. And the second thing that you sort of pointed out was, you know, if China does not attack Taiwan, I think you said roughly by mid 2024, you know, they're likely not going to attack Taiwan at all. And you know, has your view changed from that? You know, have I stated your view correctly? And you know, has your view changed from that? You know, how are you thinking about that going forward?
Let's see. So first, Taiwan has continued to basically take their crown jewels and push them out, right? They've announced increased investments in the United States. That really is not all that different than you would have seen from a European principality in the event that the Austrian-Hungarian Empire was, you know, knocking on your door, or Napoleon is going to knock on your door, or for that matter, who am I looking for? Hadrian, comes knocking on your door at the Roman Empire, right? You're going to basically say, okay, before we go negotiate, let's make sure we have the capabilities to have a government in exile, right? An heir goes abroad, the crown jewel goes abroad to a safe place. Inevitably, it ends up that, you know, your heir gets murdered when they arrive, the crown jewels get stolen and sold to your enemies in exchange for you know, lands that are then subsequently divided up. But nonetheless, you do the best you can to establish the conditions for a government in exile. I think that's what Taiwan is in the process of doing. Does China try to take Taiwan? That's really an unknown, right, at this point. They've clearly indicated they want to. They clearly view it as something that is important for them. But the further off it goes, the harder it becomes to effectively jump, right? It's rapidly turning into a situation that feels very much like, you know, I could have been a contender sort of thing, right? Is it slipping away from them? I don't know. I don't have any immediate information that suggests that that a move is imminent. But the longer you wait, the harder this becomes for China.
Mm-hmm. And I guess what are sort of the, so you know, from a trading standpoint or from an investing standpoint, you know, how would you, you know, let's say you believe that there was going to be a Chinese invasion of Taiwan, and, you know, we're speaking in Feb 2023, and let's say by the end of 2024. So, you know, how would you sort of play that, or how would you sort of express that? Or, you know, maybe on the other side, you know, how would you hedge the risk?
Well, I think the obvious trade there, or at least the obvious trade to me, would be some sort of variant on betting on a peg in the Hong Kong, breaking the peg in the Hong Kong dollar, right? Because that, if there's an actual invasion of Taiwan, you know, then it becomes almost impossible to imagine that the U.S. maintains the special relationship and the lines of credit and the swap lines, et cetera, that allow Hong Kong to continue to maintain its peg to the U.S. dollar. We'd probably try to immediately hit China by penalizing its financial system in the same way that we did Russia. And on those sorts of conditions, I mean, I can't see how Hong Kong maintains the peg.
And so the situation that would be, I guess, I guess that makes sense. And so, but doesn't the fact that the HKMA, it has about the HKMA has in reserves about 6 times the total monetary value of Hong Kong dollar currency. You know, does that...
Where are those reserves held?
I'm not fully sure.
I mean, they're held in SWIFT related banks, right? So if we simply say you can't actually spend them,
right? They can have the reserve, but they can't do anything with the reserves. So, okay.
They become personas non grata.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. And Mike, you know, is there anything that, you know, we haven't touched upon in the podcast that you would like to talk about?
Well, the biggest thing that I've tried emphasizing for people is that the behavior of the Fed in terms of hiking interest rates is actually causing supply to contract more rapidly than demand. And I've made this point since, you know, July of last year, that the behavior of the Fed is ultimately counterproductive. By hiking interest rates, they're creating conditions that, while they pale in comparison to what we saw in the 1970s, could actually cause some of those events to reemerge, right? If you're convinced that the answer to inflation is to hike inflation, who are those that are most positioned to respond to that hike in interest rates? It's companies making a decision about how much inventory to hold, companies that are making a decision about how much capacity to expand, et cetera. And the answer is they don't,
mm-hmm.
right? And we're seeing this. I mean, we're seeing once the shortages disappeared in automotives, we're not seeing a major snapback in terms of production, right? If I look at auto sales, I actually had this just up. You know, the car production levels now, vehicle assemblies. You know, domestically, we're running at 9.6, right? 9.6 million. That is a level that is down.
9.6 million what?
9.7 million vehicle assemblies, both autos and light trucks, were made domestically in were made on an annualized basis in December.
Okay.
Now that's up, but it has turned back down and is effectively for a seasonally adjusted number, and is showing a pattern that is consistent with most recessionary conditions. We're actually at a level, despite the fact that our population is much larger, despite the fact that auto prices are high, we're looking at a situation where we're producing below the levels that we were as we started the recession in 2007. That's pretty incredible when you stop and think about it. And we're down from, you know, 2015, 2016 levels north of 12 million, right? So we're down 25% in our auto production and have been falling on a relatively consistent basis now for going about 6 or 7 years. That's pretty extraordinary when you think about it.
It is. And so we're sort of seeing so we're seeing the supply side contract a lot faster than the demand side is. And so
we're seeing the willingness to make the investments to expand supply, to increase inventories, et cetera, is diminishing rapidly.
Okay. Got it. Awesome.
So, to summarize all of it, like, this is a very challenging period in which we're watching behavior that suggests that this is truly a different type of recession, that it's going after the middle class. This is very much consistent with the Brynjolfsson and I think it was McAfee or Mac. It was Brynjolfsson and give me 1 second here. Eric Brynjolfsson and yeah, McAfee. Sorry, I was thinking John McAfee. I wanted to make sure Andrew McAfee is the co-author with him of a book called The Second Machine Age, right? Work, Progress, and Prosperity. We've forgotten all of these papers that were written in that time period. And again, this is the point of the Substack that I just did. And for those who don't know who the hell I am, I'm at ProfPlum99. You can find my work on Substack through my Twitter account. We've forgotten that all these books were written that explained why we were going to have permanently lower growth, why the world was going to look very, very different. And as those forecasts begin to come true, people are suddenly sitting there saying, well, maybe they can solve the problem now. We didn't solve it, right? We've got all the same issues. And so what Brynjolfsson and McAfee referred to was the tuna can recession. And it was describing the fact that the extremely wealthy, those who own the capital, and the extremely low end, those who are doing the most physical of jobs, would find themselves in better position than those in the middle. And that's really what we're watching. We're watching an assault on the middle class. We're watching an assault on the idea of work hard, get a good job, get a college degree, get a good job, and things are going to be fine. We're seeing that replaced with a distinctive uncomfort or discomfort that is manifesting itself in a lot of different ways.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense. Yeah. And with that, Mike, thank you so much for being on the podcast. You know, it's been a while since you've been on. And, you know, as you mentioned, you know, people listening can find you at ProfPlum99, ProfPlum99. And your Substack is just michaelwgreen.substack.com. And it's called Yes, I Give a Fig, if I remember correctly.
Yes, that's right. Yes, I give a fig. It's jokingly referring to the ETF that I manage that has that ticker.
Awesome. Awesome, Mike. Thank you so much for being on the podcast. It was awesome. It was awesome having you on.
Absolutely a pleasure, Sri. And I'm thrilled to hear that you're doing so well.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Market Champions. To never miss an episode, make sure to subscribe and we'll see you next time.